First of all, has everyone heard Dharma before? No. Kind of, sort of first time? No. I feel very lucky then. I really, actually, in fact, enjoy very much talk about the Dharma, the meaning of the Dharma, with people that haven't heard the Dharma before, because Dharma means truth. And so, and we'll get into that, the four truths we're going to talk about tonight, tomorrow night, and the night after, the four truths. The reason that Dharma, the Sanskrit word Dharma means truth, is not because we believe it or not. Essentially, truth means if it's in accordance with reality. And so the thing about Buddha Dharma, and especially the Buddha Dharma that was preserved or maintained in Tibet for the last 1,200 years or so, it became part of the culture. And there's a fair amount of ritual and prayer and kind of outer, like external manifestation of chants and prayers and mantras and ritual. And the purpose for that really is, in fact, to maintain a kind of a skeleton on which the truth sort of hangs from generation to generation. It's sort of like otherwise, if it's just people getting together and talking from generation to generation, then it will lose focus. And so we have to really understand that when we do perform ritual and when we do recite refuge prayers and so on and so forth, it's just a way of organizing a conveyance or a vehicle to hold a tradition that goes from generation to generation. But in and of itself, you know, the prayers and the rituals don't necessarily have any particular inherent power without understanding. And so tonight, for example, we're going to chant, I guess, a refuge prayer and things like that. But it's important to realize that it's not just empty ritual, but it has some significance. And if we continue to study Dharma, the meaning of the ritual will become, the ritualistic aspect will become richer and richer and more and more profound. And also then ritual and prayer becomes kind of an ally of ours, an ally for a vehicle for meditation, a vehicle for meditation. Okay, so this is really important. In essence, okay, so when we say prayers, like normally, you know, for example, where's Kent? Is he? Okay. All right. So, Roy, what prayer do you normally say in the beginning? You don't?
It runs a range. We usually don't.
Don't. Okay. Okay. So we're gonna. Well, I'd feel really strange if we didn't take refuge first. So please indulge me, and also I'd feel really strange if we didn't generate bodhicitta first either. You know, so we're going to take refuge and generate bodhicitta using Tibetan prayer, and I'll give a brief explanation of that. And then we're going to offer the entire phenomenal universe like this, and then we'll begin. That's the bare minimum. The prayer that we're going to chant, I know that some people know it, it goes Lama Sangye Lama Chö Desha Lama Gyetan Dzogchen. It's a Tibetan prayer. And means that the teacher is the, for example, if we consider His Holiness the Dalai Lama and also my teachers. I have three primary teachers that will be present indirectly somehow this evening. Lama Thubten Nyeshe was deceased, and now his incarnation is in India. Lama Thubten Zopa, and the the Mahaguru Toshig Rinpoche, captured Toshig Rinpoche. So anyway, those three teachers are my primarily my teachers, and so everything I know I learned from them. And pretty much I can say that everything that has happened in my life is good, since I met them, is pretty much due to their kindness. Because in essence, it's from my teachers that I kind of learned basically kind of how to live. And I'm not the sort of person that is cult follower or anything like that. And I subjected all three of my teachers to a rather rigorous and very sanguine or pessimistic view for a long time. I watched them behave in a number of different situations over quite a period of time before I realized or before I accepted the fact that maybe they had something to teach me, because I was pretty I have many character defects, but at that time I had more. So I was young and real arrogant, and so so when the teacher means lama, means teacher, is the Buddha. Teacher is the Dharma. Teacher is the Sangha. Okay. Now that's profound, because it has a level of interpretation that in fact we have three doors. We have the body, this one. We have the speech, the vehicle of communication, and we have the mind. Okay, so the root of all behavior is the mind. Everything that we say, everything that we do, in essence is an enactment or a behavior or a reflex to some sort of mental activity. And so, in fact, when we say that prayer, that when we think Buddha, we think that the mind, the transformation of the mind, because in fact it's our mind that becomes enlightened. You know, our speech does not become enlightened, or our bodies become the vehicle of enlightenment until the mind becomes enlightened. So when we say the teacher is the Buddha, you know, we can also think that that is analogous to our mind. So when we take refuge in the teacher, we actually take refuge in an external symbol for our own potential, which means it's our mind that becomes free of suffering and the cause of suffering. It's our mind that attains unconditional compassionate love for all universal living beings. And it's our mind that attains freedom from the wheel of birth and death through the force of pristine wisdom. And that's the promise of Dharma. So when we take refuge in a sense, in a deep inner sense, we take refuge in our own potential for enlightenment, or in other words, our own Buddha nature. And the external teacher is merely an external representation of our own potential. And so by looking at the teacher as a Buddha, in fact, it doesn't necessarily matter from the side of the teacher what the qualities are. The fact is that because we choose to view the teacher in that way, it awakens within us our own potential for enlightenment. And that is very important. Generally the approach to spiritual fulfillment is based on the fact that we take refuge in an experience that we can never realize. You know, for example, when I was a kid, I used to go to a parochial school, Catholic school in Salt Lake City, one place called St. Anne's. You know, Daughters of Charity group. In fact, in that time, you know, it's sort of like, I remember very clearly, my father also was an Episcopal priest. So, you know, I grew up in a basic, I guess you'd say, Judeo-Christian model of spiritual practice. And one thing that I always had a problem with was that which I was taking refuge in was something that I could never hope to experience within myself. And that put a damper on the whole thing. And I could never quite get okay with that. You know, that I was taking refuge in Christ or God, which there was like this eternal dualism. That I was always going to be, even if I went to heaven, I could never be total. You know, it was like I always had to be less than for eternity. I don't know, maybe this is just my trip, but that is something I realized when I was younger, that I was never going to be able to reconcile myself to the teachings that were available to me at the time. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus Christ didn't have a whole tradition of mystical spiritual development that didn't necessarily survive the Council of Nicene, you know, because things got changed around quite a lot at various times in history. But the way that it was presented to me was that I was kind of having to make peace with the fact that I was never going to attain enlightenment. And this is very important when it comes to the Mahayana, because in Mahayana Buddhism, we promise or we devote ourselves to the attainment of enlightenment itself. Not a lesser enlightenment, or not an enlightenment that is not the same as the actual Buddha's enlightenment. It's the same. We commit ourselves to the attainment of enlightenment. And the reason that we commit ourselves to the attainment of enlightenment is for the benefit of all universal living beings everywhere. And so that our lives and the quest for enlightenment, that our lives become, our lives themselves become the expression of compassionate love. Mm. And this, for me, became kind of, this gave a whole new understanding. For example, when I would read the New Testament of Jesus Christ, when I would read what he said, I saw it in a whole different way. And I think that I'd like just to clarify that point, that when we're practicing Buddhism, the idea is that we're not going to attain somebody else's realization. We're not going to attain somebody else's liberation. The reason that we practice Buddhism is to attain liberation within our own streams of being, and to take the wisdom that comes out of that process into every thought, word, and deed, and everything that we do with our three doors, in other words. Our body, speech, and mind becomes the expression of compassionate love and wisdom. And it's the Mahayana premise that this is the way to get to find the meaning of life. You know, that's pretty much in a nutshell. So when we say these prayers, it's important to know that this is the kind of thing that they're talking about. It's not talking about some kind of empty form somewhere, but it's about taking upon oneself the transformation of the mind, and through that the transformation of the speech, and also the transformation of the body. So that everything we do, our bodies become instruments of compassionate love, our speech and wisdom. Our speech becomes an instrument of compassionate wisdom, and our mind becomes the spontaneous manifestation of compassionate wisdom. And in essence, that transformative process is what the 84,000 articles of Buddhist teaching are about. So anyway, we'll get more into that. So we're gonna, the first thing, this prayer, Lama Sangye Lama Chö, means that. The teacher is the enlightened being, which means, in fact, our mind. The teacher is the Dharma. The Dharma is the teaching that brings about the transformation of mind. So then Dharma means truth, as I said. And then the third thing, the teacher is the Sangha, which means the spiritual community, and that's the transformation of our bodies. So in essence, when we realize Buddha Dharma, our minds become Buddha, our speech becomes Dharma, and our bodies become Sangha. And if we stick around with the Dharma for a while, Buddha Dharma, it's going to be Buddha Dharma, Sangha, Buddha Dharma, like that. But there's an esoteric and a deeper understanding that in fact our minds become Buddha, our speech becomes Dharma, and our bodies and the actions that we perform become Sangha. So that the three jewels of refuge, in fact, are contained within us. So, that's the meaning of this first prayer that we say. And then the second prayer is for the benefit. It says, Dagdang Shenden. Dag means for myself, and Dang Shen, others. Dun means the meaning. So it means to fulfill the meaning of life for myself and all other living beings. I am going to generate the wish to attain enlightenment. That's what that second prayer means. So that's the second prayer. And then the last one, this one, is Sashi Puki. This one, Sashi, means, in fact, it means the entire phenomenal universe. So when we say that third prayer, this third one, then think that everything that you can think of, and in the infinite past, in the boundless present and in the infinite future, which means the totality of existence, infinity in essence. We, in essence, offer infinity to the enlightened beings who have been successful in their quest for enlightenment, just as we aspire to be successful in our quest as well. Anyway, this becomes easier and easier to understand. And so first the refuge prayer. Lama Sangye Lama Che Dejin Lama Ge Donde Kwangye Je Bo Lama Te Now the second prayer is bodhicitta. In order to attain enlightenment, in order to be a benefit to myself and also all other living beings, I generate the wish to attain enlightenment myself. Da da shen dun du ble du da gi chang chu sam ge do. In this last prayer, the entire phenomenal universe, all the good things in the universe, we offer. So think of all the things from which you derive pleasure. You offer that to the infinite past, present, and future beings who have attained enlightenment before us. Translations of those prayers. One reason I like to say them in Tibetan is not really for any other reason, other than the fact that what we're going to study tonight, tomorrow night, the night after, we'll hear it referred to as Tibetan Buddhism. It's not Tibetan Buddhism. It's Buddhism that was preserved in Tibet for 1,200 years. And it was Buddhism that came from India before that. Now, the fact is, it's very, very kind of interesting to watch that from India, which was south of the Himalayas and had one particular culture that was essentially Hindu-based culture in India. And then around, I guess, the 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries, then there was a large influx of Islamic influence with the conquest of the Mughals of northern India. and so India was essentially Hindu and Muslim, and Tibet was an animistic religion called Burnpo, and they were rather I guess we could liken it to a shamanistic or animistic spiritual way of life that included within it human sacrifice. So the Tibetans were like not exactly gentle people in the 6th, 5th, and 6th centuries. They were feared. They were feared by China. They were feared by Nepal. They were feared by Mongolia. Because they were able to live on the Tibetan Plateau, which is anywhere from, it averages 11 to 16,000 feet. So when the Tibetans decided to leave Tibet and to go down into, you know, the gentle hills and vales of Nepal and China, no one could stand up to the Tibetans because they were just really rough and rugged people. And one of the kings of Tibet recognized that the Tibetans, by contrast, were very barbaric compared to the Chinese people and the Tibetan or the Nepali people. And he realized that the civilizing influence in those cultures was their spiritual belief, Buddha Dharma. Okay, so Buddha Dharma, as we practice it, was, I guess, for lack of a better word, spawned in northern India at the time when Hinduism was the prevalent religion in India. And then Buddha Dharma developed further during the Mughal invasion as well. And so the Buddhism that went to Tibet was essentially from India that had been Hindu. Well, okay, so the Hindu religion is quite different than the Bonpo religion. Very different. And the Tibetans were Bonpo, and they'd been Bonpo since time immemorial. But then Buddha Dharma came into that culture too. And then, of course, we all know that then, you know, for the next 1,200 years, then Buddha Dharma was extended in Tibet, which is essentially kind of a feudal, F-E-U-D-A-L, I guess, that's the way it's called, kingdom. And very different than the 20th century America. In the same way that Tibet was very different than India. So the Buddha Dharma went from India to Tibet, especially with the invasion of the Mughals, the Muslims from Persia, came into Afghanistan and where it is now Pakistan and northern India, and obliterated Buddha Dharma in northern India at the same time that the Tibetans were hungry for Buddha Dharma on the other side of the Himalayas. And so there was kind of a historical or a, yeah, I guess you'd say, a, yeah, an epochal, a historic conjunction of energy there. The Tibetans were wanting Buddha Dharma, and Buddha Dharma was being obliterated by the invasion of the Mughals. So Buddha Dharma went over the Himalayas into Tibet. And without negating Tibetan culture, was able to assimilate Tibetan culture into Buddhism. And that's essentially the strength of Buddhism. And I saw actually a year ago in February, I saw on Time magazine where the cover was the Americanization of Buddhism. And that really, like, that was amusing. You know, Buddha Dharma is 2,500 years old, and so it's like the main premise of Buddha Dharma is that all compounded phenomena are impermanent. And so, you know, the pillar of Buddhist thinking is that everything is transient. And so we're going to put our American spin on that. We're going to... see, that's why it's called Dharma. Why it's called the truth is because the central premise of Buddhist or Dharma thinking is that is founded upon basic fundamental truths, one of which is that nothing lasts forever, including this earth, including this solar system, including this galaxy, And if that's true, then it's like our believing in the permanence of me is a complete waste of time. And not only that, but it's a cause of a great deal of unhappiness. That's what we're going to talk about. So in any case, Buddhism went from India to Tibet, and then from Tibet, now exactly the same thing happened. The Chinese come into Tibet at the same time that American and Western people are realizing that they're not finding all of their needs are getting met by the existing spiritual paths that are available. You know, either the spiritual or the philosophical or the psychological or whatever. It's like, you know, we tried the therapy and we tried the Judeo-Christian model and we tried whatever, psychedelics and other things that we did, and we tried everything. And it's like none of that worked. Right at the time that the Chinese are invading Tibet and the Tibetans, certain Tibetan holders of the Buddhist lineages were driven into exile, at the time that people were starting to wander around the world looking for some sort of answer. And so there the Tibetans and Western people met in places like Dharamsala and Nepal and northern India. And they started to really understand that this had something to offer. And so these people again turn around and come back to the United States and Australia and Europe and so forth. And they begin to set up little like cells, revolutionary cells like this place. What's the name of this center? Is this Gelagatso?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's virtual.
Okay, virtual. Okay, the virtual Dharma Center. It's perfect. You know, Silicon Valley virtual Dharma Center. That's not the only thing that's virtual. According to Buddha Dharma, virtually everything is virtual. So, this thing about Buddha Dharma is it can go anywhere. And it just says the same thing it always says, and it's always true. Anyway, so and this is based upon one's own experience, in which we will get into. enough about history. I do like to say the prayers in Tibetan is a way of also paying homage to the generations of Tibetans who committed their lives to the realization of Buddha Dharma, and it's for that reason that we have an unbroken lineage that comes down to us today. That there's an unbroken lineage. It's not like we're studying something that some kind of arcane or archaic or esoteric spirituality that is not connected directly to the enlightened being or Buddha. The actual Buddha, and because in fact there is that lineage. It existed in India, it was passed to the Tibetans, and now it's coming into the United States, and it's an unbroken tradition. By reciting the prayers in Tibetan, I find that also a way for me to acknowledge and to honor the Tibetans that have realized the Dharma within their own streams of being, and enable us to meet together tonight, right now. This gathering in this moment is in fact due to the kindness of many generations of Tibetans who sacrificed their lives really for the preservation of the Mahayana path to enlightenment. And so this tradition comes to us because it works. If it was an ineffective method, we wouldn't be here tonight, because people would have abandoned it as a valid spiritual path a long time ago. And so the reason that we're able to meet together tonight is because people have been realizing the meaning of Dharma in an unbroken tradition for a long time. And saying the prayers in Tibetan is a way to acknowledge the selfless endeavors that the Tibetan people have put into the preservation of Buddhism for many generations. uh, However, okay, and His Holiness will be one, the first, I've heard Him say this many times, just because it's Tibetan doesn't mean it's Buddhist. So this is one of our jobs when we're going to study Buddha Dharma. We have to be able to discern what is Buddhist and what is cultural, you know. And just because a person is a Tibetan, or just because a person is not a Tibetan, is not a criteria for judging whether it's a valid Dharma path or not. And that's something that it's our responsibility to be clear about what is true. And what is not true? We have to make up our own minds about that. Okay. Okay. So. I think a really good place to start is to start with the legend of the appearance of Shakyamuni Buddha in the world. I think so I'm going to just briefly tell the story of Shakyamuni Buddha. When Shakyamuni Buddha was born, the father of Shakyamuni Buddha was a king. In the Kapilavastu near Lumbini on the border of Nepal and India. And so when Shakyamuni Buddha was born, he was the crown prince of this kingdom. And so they called the astrologer, the court astrologer, to come and do Shakyamuni Buddha's chart. And so when the astrologer, this is the legend, and it's kind of important. So when the astrologer did Shakyamuni Buddha's chart, the signs demonstrated that Shakyamuni Buddha was either going to become a great world leader, you know, president of Southeast Asia, conqueror, what they call Chakravartin, means like a wheel, a universal emperor, like that, or he was going to bag the kingdom and take off and become a spiritual king or leader. Well, his dad wasn't into that because his dad was the king and wanted his son to be the crown prince, to provide heirs and to take over the reins of power when he got too old to do that. And so he was very distraught. Also, simultaneously, the astrologer that came and was doing the chart wept when he saw the signs in the chart, and the king asked him what the problem was, and he said that his own chart said that when he saw this kind of a chart, that it meant that he wouldn't see the next sunrise. So he was unhappy, you know. So in any case, then the king, you know, commiserated, and I'm very sorry, but you know, you're handing me this chart. And it's true, the story is that the astrologer died before sunrise the next day. Shakyamuni Buddha's father got out of the astrologer how to keep him from renouncing the kingdom and becoming the heir and the ruler of Kapilavastu, and then to spread the influence of Kapilavastu throughout that part of the world. And so the astrologer said, well, you're going to have to keep him from seeing old people or sick people or corpses. If you can keep him from seeing these things, then he will not arouse the thought of renunciation or disillusionment, and therefore he'll stay at home. But if he sees these things, it's going to start within him. It will be a germinal experience. It will start within him a questioning and a process by which he will, one thing will lead to the next, and he will gradually become disillusioned and realize that he has to leave the kingdom. So, and this is just a story, but it's interesting. So anyway, then there's a big conspiracy that every time Shakyamuni Buddha would leave the palace compound, advanced people would go out and they'd clean everything up. You know, just like when Clinton comes to San Francisco, all of a sudden there's no more homeless people around, and you know, they all get sort of rounded up and off the streets, so that when he's exactly like that. You know, so in any case, when Shakyamuni Buddha would go out, then all kind of young people would be there and strewing flowers and singing songs and incense, and everybody, it was all good. You know, and so every time he went out, everybody was telling him how beautiful he was and what a great king he's going to be and everything like that. So whenever he went around, he thought everything was like, this is the way it should be. Okay, and that went on for quite a long time, until one day, of course the story is, he saw an old, weazened person, you know, he's going like this, and falling apart. And he went like to his driver, what's this? And his driver said, well, you know, that's an old person. And he goes, well, what happened? And the driver said, well, that's what happens, you know, if you live long enough, that's what you look like. And that disturbed him. So he went back to the palace, and things weren't quite the same after that. Okay, and some time passed, a little bit later, and he sees this sick person that's kind of like getting ready to die, and they have like flies on their, you know, like on the eyelids, and people are, you know, trying to get the flies off, and the person's obviously in very bad shape. Great suffering. So again, Shakyamuni Buddha asks, well, what's up with this? And the driver says, well, that's a sick person. And he goes, well, what happened? And he said, well, that's what everybody gets sick sometime or another. And usually you get sick, you know, the older you get, then you get sick more often. You become more vulnerable. And so then that also disturbed Shakyamuni Buddha quite a lot. And he started to kind of like mope around the palace. It's like didn't talk like usual. Wasn't in such good spirits. And then finally, of course, eventually he sees a corpse. And that really, I don't know, if people ever seen like just, you know, corpses, they're kind of unsettling because there's nobody there, but it's weird. Now, I guess, you know, you see, the last dead body I saw was a friend of mine. he died of a rare form of cancer, and so he languished for a very long time, and then he passed away, and then they had to prepare the body for a viewing, embalmed and made up and everything. He looked like a big doll. It was strange. Anyway, so Shakyamuni Buddha, when he saw a corpse, and that was very disturbing. He asked the driver, what's up with that? And the driver said, he's dead. And Shakyamuni Buddha said, well, you know, dead means like, and says, well, you know, that's when, you know, you're dead. This life is over, and you leave your body behind, and you carry on. You go somewhere else. And then Shakyamuni was profoundly disturbed by that. Goes back to the palace, and now he's just depressed. And the way that it's described is like depression. He's suffering from depression. He's unhappy with, like, his relationship wasn't doing it for him anymore. His kids, he had a couple of sons that they weren't doing it for. Some says it, one story says one, but generally I think there's two. His family, his friends, his old diversions, playing sports. He was kind of an athlete. Didn't do it. None of that worked any longer. He couldn't get happy no matter what he was doing. And then at one point he saw a mendicant, or someone that had no shoes and just were wearing the rags of a funeral pyre, you know, the what do you call it, the shroud of a person that had was being prepared for cremation. They take the shroud off of people when they burn them. And get our whole sadhus in India, mendicants, ancient tradition, they wear funeral shrouds as their regular clothes. So he saw a mendicant or a sadhu walking along with just a bowl and no shoes, and his raiment was a shroud wrapped around. But he walked among the people with a great deal of serenity and strength, and he was obviously at peace, and he had nothing. And so that caused Shakyamuni Buddha to think, well, you know, it can't happen here in the palace, and I'm disturbed, and none of this means anything to me anymore. So therefore, I should renounce this and try to find inner peace. Okay. Now, we can think what we want about the story, but if we look at what happens right now, when we look at television, when we look at how things are hyped in our culture, the way that we treat aging, and the way that we treat illness, and the way that we treat death, it's exactly like that. And it's like there's a conspiracy to keep us from becoming disillusioned with worldly existence. Because if you get a whole culture of people disillusioned with worldly existence, then things as we know them would be very, very different. Now, it's not that there's some kind of, some kind of Dr. Evil person that's out there trying to, mount a conspiracy to keep the pot people of the world in the dark, you know. But it doesn't need that, because our own delusion and our own denial as a species will make sure that those things stay in place. You know, that the way that we think about our own deaths, the way that we think about impermanence, the way that we think about where happiness, the origin of happiness, and how to become happy, all of this is exactly according to this legend. And so it's kind of a cute story, or I don't know if it's cute or not, but it's an interesting archaic historical kind of like legend. But in fact, that's exactly what happens. That the way that we try to make ourselves happy with transient or transitory toys, relationships, you know, sweet ego pleasing type of friends, and I'm not putting those things down, but we're just talking now about where the true happiness and the true happiness and the true cause of happiness arise. And it does not arise from our relationships. It does not arise from what we've been able to accomplish in terms of our careers. It does not arise from how much material we've been able to accumulate. It doesn't arise simply because we're healthy. Inner peace or happiness is an internal phenomenon that is realized through the force of wisdom. And this is something that it's hard. It's kind of a hard pill to swallow. But in fact, if we look deeply, or if we penetrate the superficial appearance of things and take a clear look on a deeper level, we see that this is true. I'm a substance abuse therapist, and I've worked in the projects of San Francisco, and I've worked in Woodside. And you know what? This is interesting, okay. A lot of the people that I've worked with in the projects of San Francisco have fairly good support from their families, for example. You know, they can be all messed up on crack and all other kind of things because they grew up in a project and they have not very much opportunity and they've been traumatized a lot and there's a lot of violence and a lot of crap going on. But when it comes down to where they can go, they have some place to go where their mom is there and their sisters are there or their brothers are there, and you know, like that. They have family. Whereas I've noticed that people from Woodside that I deal with, when they try to get their lives together and the aftermath of the chaos that comes about from alcoholism or drug addiction, they have no refuge. They don't have any place to go. And I've noticed that people with all of their material possessions are actually much more miserable, and their quality of lives are not as good as people that I've worked with in the projects and are able to realize that, hey, listen, I have a life here. And they become outreach workers or whatever like that. And so that for me has been a very powerful teaching, that the Dharma is true, that happiness and peace of mind is not dependent upon the amount of material that you have. I know some really miserable rich people, and they're miserable, and they're messed up, and they're frightened, and their relationships are completely coming apart, and they feel like shit. And they have all this money, and that doesn't do a damn bit of good for them. I know a lot of folks like that. So, you know, I think that it's just kind of important to sort of like look, when we learn about Dharma, we listen to what the Dharma is saying and then turn it around and apply it to our own experience. And if it's true, okay. If it's not true, then, well, you know, it's not. We only need to waste a couple of hours then before we get on with our lives. But if it is true, then it's a very good thing to maybe pursue it a little bit further, because we might be able to unravel the hindrances that block the spontaneous experience of inner peace through recognizing the truth. That's why they're called four truths of the Aryas. It's because they're called truths, Dhamma, because they're not made up. They're not fantasized by someone and then say, oh, this is the truth. They're the truth that we can either see and prove or disprove on the basis of our own experience. And they've been around a while. So, I think that's interesting. So anyway, I didn't mean to get off the subject, but it's hard. I could almost say anything and I wouldn't get off the subject of the four truths of the Aryas, because the four truths of the Aryas pretty much includes the whole ball of wax. It's all there. Okay, the main point is that when we look at the way that the delusion or the false belief in the mode of existence of all universal phenomena, when we realize that this false belief is the root of our problems, the real cause of suffering, then we become motivated to look at things in a way that makes more sense. And I would exhort and hope that people will return tomorrow and Sunday, because there's a fair amount of material, but in fact it all builds, the material builds on itself, or that is a progression. And through the progression, the beginning part begins to make more sense. So it's more like a circle. And so when we talk about the four truths of the Aryas, what will happen is that the truth of suffering and the cause of the truth of suffering and the cessation of suffering and the path that brings the cessation of suffering work in tandem with each other. So it's not possible really to separate one from the other. That they work in tandem with each other. So the four truths of the Aryas, it's not the three truths of the Aryas or the two truths of the Aryas or the five truths of the Aryas. It's the four truths of the Aryas. What Arya means? Yeah, exalted one, Arya. Okay, Arya in Sanskrit, why it's called exalted one is not because of any type of stature in society. Exalted one means one who has relinquished or extinguished the cause of suffering within the stream of their own being. And that person's an exalted one. And so from the Buddhist perspective, we can say that there's only two kinds of living beings. Now, how many species are on the planet? I don't know. Lots. Different creatures, insects, and all different kinds, you know. And so, and then also there's all those millions of extinct creatures as well. And so, according to Buddha Dharma, that throughout infinite time and space, all living creatures can be included in two types: ordinary and exalted, ordinary and extraordinary. And that's the only kind of creatures there are. ordinary beings are those who live under the influence of delusion. And this is very interesting because we, in Buddhism, we have struggled with a concept for what is meant by delusion. They call it beginningless delusion, beginningless ignorance. But if we look at that, okay, in the light of, let's say, the Darwinian approach to the evolution of species, we can say that beginningless delusion is in fact instinct. Instinct. That, in fact, this is I think a fairly deep topic. In that, if we look at the ability of the creatures of the sea to swim, and we look at the ability of the winged animals to fly, and then the animals of the earth to to evolve with different survival powers of survival, like for example camouflage, for example very aggressive or weapon-like features, fangs and claws, for example, also like cockroaches that are very good at surviving. I think cockroaches are considered to be the oldest living species on the planet. Now, all of these living creatures, if you look at them, they have a will to live. They have instinct, and yet they're not enlightened. And so this instinct is, in fact, we can draw the analogy between instinct and beginningless delusion. Now, why this human existence from the Buddhist perspective is considered especially precious or an especially valuable opportunity is because right now, in the infinite flow of time and space, we have a body-mind composition that is over very, very rapidly, but we have an opportunity right now to set ourselves free from the wheel of conditioned existence. Whereas other life forms, beautiful though they may be, I wouldn't want to trade places with one myself. Maybe, I've heard people say, well, I'd like to be my dog, My dog lives a pretty good life. I've heard people say, oh, I'd love to be an eagle. But if you think about the reality of those sentient beings' experience, I don't think it's, when I think about it, I can't be real happy at the idea that I would be any animal form that I can think of. I wouldn't want to be a spider. I wouldn't want to be any of those things. And if we really think about the reality of what an animal's life is like, they suffer in a number of different ways. Like they suffer from delusion, they suffer from fear. They're somewhere on the food chain, they are not able to experience a level of wisdom able to experience a level of meaning that comes from realizing the true nature of all universal phenomena. They're not able to realize a state of compassionate love that encompasses all universal living beings. Example of a pet dog, very loyal to their particular person. And yet, they're not able to develop the type of compassionate love that encompasses all universal living beings. And so in other words, and this is important, that what drives conditioned existence or the lack of fulfillment of conditioned existence is delusion or instinct. And so it's the Buddhist promise or the Buddhist path of liberation to actually transcend instinct. Now, I guess that we can take that one step further and say, well, in fact, we can't ever transcend instinct. That even enlightenment is the final destination of instinct. That if the evolution of life is to find true happiness and the cause of happiness, if the evolution of life is constantly evolving toward a final state of peace, then enlightenment is a when question, not an if question. In infinite time and space, some life form is going to attain enlightenment. Because until now, since beginningless time, life forms have been coming into and out of existence and have been always conditioned by the quest for happiness or peace. And if we look, for example, at fawns, they have spots, and their color is kind of tan when they're younger because they blend into they're not so easy to see. So in fact, what is the driving force behind the spots on a deer in that case? It's fear. You know, otherwise they're kind of like sitting ducks. They're somewhere on the food chain. Now, with every life form, it is like that, and even the human race. For example, it will be interesting to see what happens with time. I mean, if we look at the Earth, maybe human beings become a parasite from the point of view of the Earth. You know, because we tear down everything and blow things up and make disharmony, and you know, we're taking a toll on the planet. The other night, it was interesting, I heard Gorbachev, who I hadn't heard since his wife died, but he gave a talk on television. It was sometime in the middle of the night, and I looked at it. And it was very enlightening to listen to him talk about what we're doing and what's happened to the Earth in the last 100 years. And so if we look at what the human race is doing to the Earth will not be able to bear the human race in this size. Now, I'm not a doomsday predictor and all that kind of stuff. It's not like that. But there's a threshold that the Earth can take. There's going to be only so many people before the Earth is going to start to take remedial steps. It has to. You know, an interesting thing I also did see on the Discovery Channel that giraffes started dropping dead in Africa in a game preserve there for no apparent reason. And so the zoologist went there and was studying biologists. They were trying to figure out what was killing off these giraffes, and they couldn't figure it out for quite a long time. But finally they realized that what was happening is there'd been a drought in that part of Africa for quite a while. And that the usual lower shrubs that giraffes would eat, they weren't eating any longer. They were only eating one specific type that where the foliage, the green, the nutritional part was high up. And so that particular tree became the only food source for the giraffes in that area. So that tree starts to secrete a poison that was virulent to giraffes and killed them. The trees evolved somehow. They had the intelligence, the kind of innate, vital intelligence that the trees themselves began to secrete a poison that was killing the giraffes because the giraffes posed a threat to those trees. It's a scientific fact. It's interesting. So I figured, well, if the trees can figure out a way to deal with the giraffe problem, probably the Earth can figure out a way to somehow, just karma. That's what we're going to talk about, you know. Now what all this has to do with the attainment of enlightenment is that even the human race, just to be human, is not any big deal either. You know, what is a big deal is that we have, if we are fortunate enough to recognize the fact that we believe that life has some kind of purpose, we believe that a peace that surpasses understanding is possible. And we believe that the vision of universal compassionate love for all living beings is something worthwhile. We have the equipment to bring this about within us. whereas animals and other life forms don't have that same opportunity. And getting down to the cause of suffering being delusion, we can liken it to instinct that is not awakened instinct. Instinct that is awakened is called bodhicitta. Okay? So this instinct, this life force, until the concept of enlightenment takes place within us, is called delusion. Or we can call it instinct. But that same life force, when we get to the point karmically that we're able to think, well, you know, material existence is not going to satisfy me. No amount of material accomplishment or attainment is going to be the solution for me. Therefore, the only real solution exists beyond this world. Then at that moment, instinct then becomes the wish or the will to attain enlightenment. And that second prayer that we said tonight, that prayer that we said, for the benefit of myself and all other universal living beings, I am going to generate the wish for enlightenment. That means that my life force now is going to be looking for a solution to the riddle of life or to the problems of life that exist beyond anything we've ever done before. And it's kind of fascinating when you look at the fact that, like, you know, that the earth is considered, you know, kind of, we all think that the earth is so old, but in fact it's considered to be about 5 billion years old. And that, you know, various life forms have appeared and disappeared on the face of the planet through the evolution, the historical evolution of life on this planet. And yet, Buddhahood or enlightenment or awakening is the solution that brings everlasting peace of mind. Okay. So now, when Shakyamuni Buddha then finally he left the palace, took off for 6 years, nearly starved himself to death, didn't work. Finally, decided to ease up, sat down in the shade of a tree, had some food, relaxed, and that night got illuminated. When he eased up on himself, because he was trying too hard, and finally he got too exhausted, couldn't do it any longer, relaxed. Nourished himself, and then that evening, that full moon evening, then, oh, now I see. Next day, all he would do is just kind of walk around and go, wow. And for 30 days, he walked around, whew, man, awesome. And finally, he decided, well, now that this has happened, I'm going to just take off and sit down and enjoy myself in samadhi for the rest of however long. And then the story is that manifestation of Brahma appeared to him and said, you can't do that, you have to teach. And he said, yeah, but this is too simple and too deep. Nobody's going to understand it, because it's way simple, but it's very profound. And then Brahma said, well, there are some people who have just a little bit of delusion covering their wisdom. And so for those beings, you need to remain and teach. And now, who those beings are those beings that maybe you can identify with this. A symptom of a person that has just a little bit of delusion is that they always feel that something is not quite right. Like something's wrong. You know, and even when they're really happy, if they stop for a second and examine the quality of that happiness, they always find that, they're never exactly totally 100% happy or free. That even, you know, even when they think back over the course of their lives, then they think that even when I was happy, I wasn't that happy, you know. So in any case, it's those people that the Dharma exists on the planet for. Dharma exists on the planet for those people. People that can't quite feel, there's something always a little bit wrong here, you know, even in the best of times. Now, what's wrong is that we haven't realized universal truth. There's still something wrong there. There's still some kind of conflict. It's deep and it's subtle, but it's powerful too. And the deal is, the Buddhist explanation is how it might feel subtle now, but at the time of death, it's not subtle at all. It becomes very, very powerful and predominant. Now, what that dichotomy is, that difficulty is, that there's a basic contradiction between ego and truth, the self and universal truth. There's a basic fundamental conflict. The ego, the self, is the product of a hallucination that we project, that we have, based upon phenomena and how they appear to us, including the self that rides upon this body-mind composition. It's like the self that rides upon this body-mind composition seems to be concrete and true. I know myself really, really well. And it's like me. We know who we are. You know, the fact is that that self, that ego that we believe in so strongly, intuitively or instinctively, we believe in that ego, the reality of that ego, in fact, is in complete contradiction to every universal phenomenon that has ever existed, exists anywhere, and ever will exist. And the resolution of that conflict or that internal contradiction is in essence what the Dharma addresses. How to realize the truth with such power and clarity that the ego and the way that it appears to us undergoes a transformation. Now that doesn't mean that that we become selfless, like having no self, like a nihilistic extreme, but it means that the self becomes the manifestation or the embodiment of wisdom, and that person is then in harmony with universal existence, and that person is at peace. And that is the central premise of the Dharma, to resolve the contradiction between appearance and the nature of appearance, between the phenomenal universe and the roles that we play in the phenomenal universe, and the nature of the phenomenal universe and the nature of the self. To resolve those two, that contradiction. So Shakyamuni Buddha acquiesced. Okay, he started wandering around, and he met five fellow mendicants that he had been practicing with, and he'd been the most austere of the six of them, and so he was kind of the most venerated by the other five. And then when he decided to relax under the shade of the tree and drink some milk and honey and ease up, having followed the ascetic path to the end, realizing that it wasn't the right way, then they abandoned him and said that he sold out. He took off. And they chastised him and left. So he's walking around and he bumped into them in a place called Sarnath, the deer park. In Bihar, not far from Benares in India. And he looked pretty happy and at peace with himself, and they went like, "Hey, well, you look really well. What's going on?" And he said, "Well, it's like this." And then he told them the sutra. It's called the spoken word of the Four Noble Truths. You know, that this is suffering, that this is the cause of suffering, that this is the cessation of suffering, and that this is the path that brings the cessation of suffering. So the Four Noble Truths Sutra was the very first Buddhist teaching, and within it is contained all of the 84,000 articles of teaching are an outcome or an evolution of the Four Noble Truths. Why did he teach suffering first? Why would you say? Denial. People are in denial. You know, it's not like, you know, people say, you know, people that drink too much and take too many mood-altering substances are in denial. But everybody's in denial. In the same way that we talked about already, the story of Shakyamuni Buddha and how we treat aging, illness, and death. Now look, when you watch television, I guess sometime, you know, we watch the game or whatever we watch the game or Ally McBeal or whatever we happen to watch, look at those commercials and see what those are about. how to be young, how to be beautiful, how to not get sick, and how to like... Do you see any commercials on how to die? There's every so often, like at 3 o'clock in the morning on some PBS channel, is like an advertisement for a hospice asking for money. But otherwise, you know, no commercials say, hey, listen, you know, with every breath you're getting closer to death, so prepare. Find Buddha Dharma now. We don't see that. Why? Because as a culture, we're in denial. As a race, we're in denial. The human race is in denial about aging, illness, and death, as among other things. The reason Shakyamuni Buddha taught suffering first is he said, this is suffering. And everybody went, suffering? He says, yeah, okay. This is how. Okay, so then, let's see, I put here, okay, now, the environment. Now we would think, okay, does that mean like, does that mean the peninsula, or does that mean California, or does that mean America, or what does that mean, the environment? Okay, the environment is where we become, where we're born, where we are. That's the environment. Okay. Now, okay, so strictly or traditionally speaking, there are six environments in a general sense from the Buddhist perspective. There are hell-like environments, there are animal-like environments, there are hungry ghost hungry ghost, I'll explain that, like environments. There's long life God environments, there are Titan realm environments, and there are people realm environments, or regular folks. Now, we don't need to get hung up on what hell and hungry ghosts and animal realms and long life God realms and Titan realms and human realms. So we don't need to get stuck with that right now. The idea is that the primary delusion that's associated with hell is rage, anger. And the primary delusion that's associated with hungry ghost is craving, attachment, and desire. I can never get enough. I get, to, you know, I want this, I want this, I want this, and we get it, and it's like, eh. You know, we become impossible to satisfy. And the way that they are cosmologically depicted in the Wheel of Life is that these are beings with giant stomachs and little teeny necks and little... like mouths the size of the eye of a needle, so that they're totally hungry and they're going around completely dissatisfied all of the time. Let's see, that's this realm, this one anyway. But they go around with giant stomachs, completely consumed or overwhelmed by hunger, and yet they can't eat enough. So they're, even when they what they eat makes causes more. Craving, attachment. And so these realms, for the time being, we can think of these realms really as just psychologically created or psychologically hallucinated states that are reflected in our own beings. Like, you know, one of my clients, for example, refers to the years that she spent with her narcissistic mother, who was had very many problems. She calls those years hell. And she during the session, she'll say, "When I was in hell," and she's referring to the years that she spent alone with her mother after her mother and father got divorced, and what was happening in the house. And for her, that became hell. And then there are, you know, we in essence, the way that hell is written about or described as things like that, the ground is made of is red hot iron, and that there are very many terrifying creatures around that enjoy to make us suffer and cut us up and harm us and make us suffer. So That's the way that hell is described is as a place of great physical suffering and incredible, unbelievable mental anguish. Unbearable. It means to be a state that is absolutely unbearable. And then the hungry ghost realm is described as a place where it is completely dissatisfied, that we are completely consumed or overwhelmed by craving attachment and longing or wanting and being unsatisfied. And the animal realm is described as being a place where creatures are motivated by fear and hunger to eat and to escape. And that the primary delusion associated with that is stupidity or instinct. And then the long life God realm is a place where everybody has a very, very good time. They are able to see beautiful things and hear beautiful sounds, and all the pleasures of the senses are readily available. And one of the qualities of the long life God realm is that two people that are attracted to each other, if they look at each other, they experience the orgasmic ecstasy simply by looking. And so this shows the description in the long life God realm is that the pleasures of the senses are replete with pleasure, and that it's like a wish granting gem, that like what you think about you get in terms of beautiful and blissful sensations. And the thing is, what's wrong with that realm? Say, hey, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that realm is that it doesn't bring happiness, and usually the rebirth right after that is downstairs. Because the time that we spend in the long life God realm, we're so distracted by enjoyment that we don't create the cause for any more enjoyment in the future. We just kind of burn up all of our good karma, so that when that karma is finished, then it's like downstairs, you know, usually in hell. Now, just by analogy, if we think about that, it's sort of like when we have attained what we wanted in our lives, like in terms of, let's say, a relationship or a job or some kind of situation where, you know, we wanted it and we have it and we enjoy it for a while and we really like it. You know, it's like usually the other shoe drops. Something happens. And then when that particular situation ends, then there's a great deal of suffering after that. So, this description of the six realms is an observation of the way that life works. And we can see the six realms reflected actually in our daily experience and in our lives. There are times in our lives that are like more like hell. There are times during a day that are more like hell. And there are people that are more like hell beings. There are different ways or interpretations or levels of looking at the description of the six realms, other than just the fact that we die from this realm and go to another realm. But we talk more about that also. But it doesn't have to be. That doesn't have to be the criteria by which we measure the truth of the suffering of the environment. Now, the particular environment that we happen to find ourselves in, from the Buddhist perspective, is the outcome of delusion. That where we end up and where we find ourselves on a moment-to-moment basis is dependent upon how we behave. And that this type of behavior brings that type of a result. Another type of behavior brings another type of result. And that, in fact, from the Buddhist perspective, the external environment, in fact, is the outcome of what's happening within us. And therefore, people that find themselves, let's say, in codependent relationships that are miserable, that's because their delusion brought them into that type of an environment. Now, on a larger scale, why some people are, let's say, born into one type of environment and others are born into another type of environment, from the Buddhist perspective, the primary cause for that exists in the previous life. That there's no other way to define or to address, to explain why some beings are born in this family and other beings are born in another family. There's no way to explain the diversity of life and the myriad of environments that life appears and life inhabits. Okay, and so when it says the environment, when it says true suffering, the environment, it means that the environment that we happen to inhabit, and that the environment that we inhabit, especially the suffering qualities of the environment that we inhabit, is the result of bad karma or unskillful behavior on our part. And that's why we find ourselves in dysfunctional environments. That dysfunctional environments, in fact, are the result of a psychological problem. That we approach life under the control of delusion, and because we approach life under the control of delusion, we find ourselves in messy situations. So, we can see from this that the Buddhist approach to problems is not, especially in our environment, is that we are not the victims of our environment. We're not victims. From the Buddhist perspective, we're not victims at all. Somehow we created the cause for this. And because we created the cause for it, we also have within our power, in the palm of our hands, the ability to create the solution as well. No one else can do that. An interesting thing to think about regarding this is that if the primary cause for our suffering was outside of us, then we would have no control over that whatsoever. We'd be utterly powerless to change that. If the primary cause for my suffering existed in my family of origin, because my mom was a drunk, my dad was a rageaholic, and I grew up like this, you know, if the primary cause for my low self-esteem and my anxiety and my depression was in my family, then I would, was caused by my family, or the primary cause for my problem is my family, then there's no way I can evolve past that. The primary cause exists within me. And then I create the cause to have a different reality. Now, it's important to look quite deeply at this, because if the primary cause did not exist within us, we would be powerless over finding happiness. We would be powerless over evolving and gaining wisdom that sets us free. But the primary cause exists within us, and therefore, if the primary cause for this exists within me, the primary cause for what I experience in the future exists within me too. And so, from the perspective of the Four Noble Truths, we begin to stop creating the cause for suffering in the future, and we begin to create the cause for experiencing happiness and the cause of happiness now. And it's a matter of time. It's a when question, not an if question, that we begin to harvest the fruit of that, or the benefits of that. Now, we might have to be patient, but just as this moment is the outcome of a previous moment, the future moment is the outcome of this moment. It's very, very logical. That's why it's called the truth. Now, we normally don't go around and think like this, but that's the point of Buddha Dharma, is to say, hey, listen, this is what's really happening. This moment that we're experiencing right now is the result of the previous moment. Now, just as the future moment, or just as this moment is the outcome of the previous moment, the future moment is the outcome of this moment. So if I behave differently now, I'm going to get a different result in the future. And that means the primary cause for our happiness and the primary cause for our suffering is here. It's not out there anywhere. So, the environment, when it says the suffering environment, when we find ourselves in screwed up places, nasty jobs and nasty relationships and nasty friends and all that kind of stuff, we have to find out what we did to put ourselves in that situation. So that when it says that the environment is suffering, it means that the dysfunctional, suffering environments that we find ourselves within, we have to realize that the cause for that is here. Now, who experiences that are all living beings. And so the first two things is the A and B is that first of all, the environment is true suffering, and the creators of that environment, sentient beings, are suffering. Okay, now how they suffer, how sentient beings suffer, is that they suffer, they experience the suffering of suffering, you know, like pain, like ouch, like that really hurts. And that's physical and emotional, mental. You know, when we're extremely unhappy or in pain. And when we experience physical pain. So the suffering of suffering. That's really easy to see. Now the suffering of change, the second and more subtle level, the suffering of change is a little bit more difficult to see, but not that much more difficult to see. Actually, it's fairly warm tonight, but kind of temperate. It's not really uncomfortably cold outside, but let's pretend for a second it was really cold outside before we came in here. It's like, okay, and we come in, you know, and we think, now we're in here and we're experiencing, you know, the release from the suffering of cold. And then we all come together and it's kind of a nice feeling. And so then we're experiencing the absence of the suffering of being alone. We come together here. Okay, now the suffering of the suffering of stuffiness and the suffering of being crowded and the suffering of being cooped up like this with somebody that's just all he talks about is suffering has already started the instant that we come in here. But it is overwhelmed or not recognized by the relief that we experience from no longer suffering experiencing the suffering of cold and being kind of like, it's going to be nice to be with some folks. The suffering of being cooped up, talking about what we're doing, has already started at that point, but we don't experience it yet because the relief from being released from the other environment is overwhelming it. But that doesn't mean that the suffering of this present moment hasn't already started. It's just that it hasn't reached the fullness of the result yet. You know, it's kind of like, for example, I get tired of sitting down, so I stand up. Whew, that feels good. Stretch my legs. But the suffering of standing up has already started. I just haven't noticed it yet. But with time, the suffering of standing up reaches the fullness of the suffering, and therefore it becomes suffering of suffering, and I have to sit down. But then the suffering of sitting down has already started. But I don't notice it yet because I'm so relieved from releasing myself from the suffering of standing up. And so goes life. The suffering of change, and we can use our lives as a great commentary on this. Well, I haven't had a relationship for real, you know, long years, you know. So I better find a friend, you know, and get into a relationship. Right? Okay, so then you find a friend, you get into a relationship, and phew, now everything's okay, I got a friend. But, you know, I often have noticed that several months later, it's kind of like, oh, God, how can I sort of, like, get out of this? Because I the suffering of the relationship has already started at the time when we first, you know, felt we found the solution. You know? And so, if we look at our lives, the way it works, that's kind of like, pretty much, you know, maybe this isn't true for everybody, and maybe the Dharma's not for everybody. If we think everything's peachy creamy the way it is, fine. I'm happy. I notice that the folks I hang around with, you know, they find that nothing really works. They get it, and then it's sort of like, it becomes a problem. It becomes, what do they say, an albatross. It becomes the solution becomes a problem. That's the suffering of change. And so it's a bit more psychologically subtle and difficult to sort of like get to. But if we are honest in the way that we look at what's going on in life, we can probably, you know, sort of identify with at least some of the observations of the descriptions of suffering. Now this also shows the incredible skill of Shakyamuni Buddha. Because when Brahma said to Shakyamuni Buddha, you have to teach people who are, you know, who have just a little delusion covering their wisdom, Shakyamuni Buddha came out with a system of teaching where people that weren't ready become ready. Well, now that you put it that way, you know, it's like, thanks a lot. Why did I ever listen? You know, why did I ever even show up and listen to this? Because now my life is totally different. So I guess knowledge, we have to one teacher in Boulder, he's deceased, Trungpa Rinpoche, but in one of his books he said, you know, you better not listen to this at all unless you're kind of like ready for a lifelong journey, because if you open the door, it's too late. And then you either follow it or you don't. And if you do follow it, you become happier and happier. And if you don't, you become more and more miserable. So it's better not even to like think about it. Anyway, so this is karma. We're coming together. Unlike this is also karma. But in any case, we can look at, well, that's natural. You know, okay, things change. Everything comes and goes. I'm okay with that. Well, if that's really the truth and you are okay with it, then I'm very happy. And you're in that category of beings that we, you know, we said the ordinary beings and then the extraordinary beings. That means that, in fact, a person's an arya. If they're really at peace with life, then then that means that they have attained a level of wisdom that is exalted or extraordinary. Now pervasive suffering. So we already know what suffering is, and now we had the suffering of change defined, and now pervasive suffering. Okay, pervasive suffering is this. Okay. My whole life, I thought I was Chris Kolb. I thought I'm Chris Kolb. My whole life. Now, Chris Kolb is this person, you know, that exists in here somewhere. And I know what he looks like. You know? Now, the fact of the matter is that if I look for Chris Kolb in every single part of this body, I don't find him anywhere. But still, I have an idea of who Chris is. I know who my true self is. Now, the thing is that then, if when I die, Chris Kolb becomes completely not extinct, like non-existent, then that means that, well, something's strange here. You know, life, the beginning of life, and the end of life. Now, something deeply within me makes it difficult for me to accept the fact that I'm born from nothing and I turn into nothing. And as a matter of fact, it's sort of like, if I think about it, well, where does life come from? Is it just some sort of an electromagnetic reaction that takes place when the sperm and egg, in this case of a human being, sperm and egg of the mother and father meet, and then there's some kind of like, poof, there's a person. That would mean that the primary cause for my existence is outside of me, in which case I have no power to transform at all. I'm just a product of an insane universe. You see? I mean, think about it. If my life, if the self, and each of us each have ourselves, is the product of an electrochemical response or reaction, that means that we are manifestations of a universe and have no choice. And that runs counter to the human experience. Anyway, think about it. Look within and think, okay, if the primary cause for me is an electromagnetic response, an electrochemical response that occurs with the meeting of semen and egg, then that means that I'm totally dependent or under the control, I'm a product of the universe. I have nothing to say. All I can do is just acquiesce and act according to my programming that the universe happens to make for me. Now, it'll take a think about it tonight and tomorrow and see what you think about that. If me, I am a product of an electrochemical response, then I have no free choice at all. I'm just some sort of like creation of an insane universe. Anyway, within yourself, think about that. Okay, now why I bring this up is that pervasive suffering, this self that I believe in, it either came from nothing and pop, there it is, and it disappears into nothing, that also doesn't seem right. If it doesn't come from nothing, it doesn't become nothing. If it doesn't rely upon a concatenation or a chain of events that was already in motion prior to this life, then that means in essence it arose from something other than it. It came from something outside, and therefore I'm a product. I have no choice at all. In which case also then on the other end, then when I die, then I again become nothing. And yet, if that were true, this present moment is impossible. Think about it. This present moment is reliant upon the previous moment, and so on and so forth. Now, at what point did the self appear? And I know it's a debate over, right to life and all this kind of stuff. People are trying to pin this down. But from the Buddhist perspective, this life force, the energy that animates this body, in fact, the cause for that was existing before the sperm and egg came together. And that this is a dependent arising that depends upon the sperm and the egg, as well as the karma of the consciousness principle that mingles with these two elements, the elements from the father and the elements from the mother. Now, this self that I believe in, okay, has absolutely nothing to do with reality. It's a hallucination. And that means that I am by nature suffering, or I am pervasively suffering because I am out of harmony with the truth. Now, a human being is composed of five components. The body, the form, feelings, good, bad, and indifferent feelings, discriminations, like being able to tell the body from the mind, or the carpet from the floor, or whatever we perceive, we discern it as one thing instead of something else. It's like, directly, if I perceive this glass of water, indirectly I'm perceiving everything else that it's not, because I'm naming this glass of water. So the fact that I directly name this makes it impossible for, makes me indirectly realize everything that this isn't. And this is kind of interesting, because when Buddha Dharma talks about omniscience, it means that because we can perceive one thing, we can perceive everything. And that by perceiving one thing, we perceive indirectly everything that isn't that thing as well. It's quite deep observation of the potential, the boundlessness of mind. And so, if I believe that this self exists truly or inherently within me somehow, then, okay, it's either oneness with the body and mind, or it's separate from the body and mind. Okay, now of the five things that human beings are composed of, four of them are mental and one of them is physical. This atom-based material body is the form, it's the physical body. Then we have feelings, we have discernment, we have impulse. That's the fourth aggregate, and the fifth one is consciousness. Now, impulse, what's that about? It's like that, and that aggregate for me was very, it took me like a long, long time to get comfortable with what was meant by compounded phenomena. The aggregate of compounded phenomena, or the aggregate of karmic formations, or the aggregate of impulse. I couldn't get a handle on that at all. What really helped, in fact, was the study of Western psychology. That's what really, really helped me understand better what is meant by that fourth aggregate. Okay, now, many people that I see, for example, they say, well, I just can't seem to not do this. I cannot seem to stop drinking. Or I can't seem to stop smoking crack, you know. Or whatever they happen to be doing. I can't seem to stop going back to him, even though he beats the crap out of me every time I go back. So then they think, well, what's wrong with me? You know? But what's really going on is that the wreckage, in fact, is the payoff in a really weird sense. And people, they don't understand. It's like if I tell somebody, well, you know, the thing is that you come and you're complaining about the wreckage from drinking, but that's really what you're after. Because you think of yourself as being worthless, because you think of yourself as being unreliable, because you think of yourself as being unworthy of a relationship, you think of yourself as being unworthy of holding down a job and having a stable life. And so therefore, every time you get close to that, you go ahead and drink, because then that puts all that way out of reach again, and you return to miserable but familiar territory. So in fact, your main problem isn't that you want to stop drinking, because you don't. And deeply, on a profound level, you want to keep drinking, and if that thinking follows its course to the end, you're going to die of alcohol poisoning sometime, and they're going to find you in the gutter, you know, with pee-pee and caca all over you. Because that's the image that you have of yourself. Now, it makes no sense from a logical perspective that somebody is going to want to do that. But in fact, because those imprints are there, we know how to act that way. We instinctively act that way. So every time a relationship gets to the threshold of becoming actually a functional good relationship, where we're going to be committed and responsible, we don't know what that's like because we've never done that before. So what a person does in that circumstance is they act out of impulse, and they go ahead and they drink, or whatever their particular behavior happens to be, because it destroys that. And so if I have this image of myself that I'm worthless, unreliable, and I always let people down, and on top of that I hate myself, then every time I get to a point where I'm either going to, pardon the expression, crap or get off the pot with this, I go ahead and drink because what it does is it reinforces this ego that I believe in. In fact, it validates the status quo. Do you understand what I'm saying? That we have this, if I identify with this person, this is me, then my behavior is going to be impulsively designed to validate this ego that I believe in. It doesn't make sense if you look at it, you know, logically. But if you look at it from what really happens, it makes a tremendous amount of sense. You know, if I think of myself as this kind of a person, then you look at the behaviors that come out from that self that I identify with. And those behaviors create an imprint on the stream of consciousness that validates that person that I believe in. And that's what is meant by the aggregate of volition, or the aggregate of impulse, or the aggregate of compounded phenomena. That when it's called impulse, it means that I instinctively am going to act upon impulses or imprints on the stream of consciousness that are in accordance with the ego that I identify with. Anyway, that's the fourth aggregate. The fifth one is consciousness itself. And consciousness is eye consciousness, nose consciousness, ear consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. Okay, so these five aggregates, four mental, one physical. Okay, we're almost at the end. Boy, tomorrow's going to go fast. We're going to start tomorrow with... Anyway, I don't want to beg, but please come back. pervasive suffering means, okay, on this body-mind composition, there's this person, Chris Kolb. Now, that person that I believe in, Chris Kolb, happens to have nothing to do with reality. So that person is headed for trouble because that person is in constant conflict with the truth. I'm bumping head-on into the universe all the time. Because my ego, myself, in fact, has nothing to do with the truth. I believe in it as being truly existing, that in here somewhere that somebody could perform surgery on me and take it, and there he is. You know, but this self that we believe in so vehemently or so adamantly, where is it? It's called a conceived object. It's almost like a mirage appearing as a lake. Now, the misapprehension of the self is like seeing a mirage as a lake or having water. The correct apprehension of the self is to say, boy, that looks like a lake, but I know it's a mirage. I'm going to stay right here and be at peace with myself and enjoy. Not walking out into the desert trying to slake a thirst with a phenomenon that's not even there. Now, that's not to say that there's not the appearance of a mirage, in the same way that it's not to say there's absolutely the self does not exist at all, but how it exists, this is the important point. Now, if we believe in the true existence of the self, then we are the victims of we are in pervasive suffering, because that false belief compels us to be in conflict with the truth. And it's often that when we look deep down inside, something's not right here. That's what's not right. Is that instinctive, that deep subconscious lack of resolution between the appearance of the self and the true nature of all universal phenomena. And that's why it's called pervasive suffering. That any being that has not resolved that conflict within themselves is experiencing pervasive suffering and is therefore an ordinary being. Beings that have resolved that are not experiencing that pervasive suffering in the same way and are therefore called exalted, because they've transcended the wrong view that holds us into the instinctive or deluded experience of life in the universe. Anyway, and so... five aggregates, Okay. In fact, and tonight was, we spent some time in the introduction, but it goes faster. It becomes, as I say in beginning, that it's a progressive topic, that one leads to the next, but it turns around and makes the beginning more comprehensible and clearer and clearer. So by understanding the four truths of the Aryas, backwards and forwards and from the middle to both ends and from both ends to the middle, all of those things work in tandem with each other. And it makes more and more sense. So, anyway, then I guess tomorrow night at 7 we meet. Is that the plan? And so maybe if we have time to sort of like think about things, maybe those three types of suffering: the suffering of suffering, which is obvious; the suffering of change, which we defined; and then the pervasive suffering, which is the result of believing in a mode of existence that isn't there. It's not there. The pervasive suffering that comes from never finding the gold at the end of the rainbow. Like that. So, thank you. And always it's important to dedicate the merits at the end. And so the idea is that by coming together this way and putting our minds toward this type of topic, we create good karma by doing this. And so that this good karma becomes not only the cause of happiness for ourselves personally, but also becomes the cause of happiness for others everywhere. That those in our immediate environment, friends, family, and so forth, directly, and then also indirectly, kind of like with a ripple effect, indirectly, all universal living beings everywhere. Because from the Buddhist perspective, all infinite living beings are interrelated and interdependent. So we dedicate this next prayer. That's what it means. That, by the virtue of coming together, by the virtue of listening to and thinking about the truth, may this become the cause for myself and all other living beings to attain happiness and the cause of happiness. That's what this next prayer means. Lama Sangye Duh.